Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we ask how a hen harrier, a protected bird of prey, was found dead in a field in County Meath. We visit a listener in Drogheda whose garden has become a magnet for hungry birds. And one small change, how the pupils of a tiny school in County Cork have taken the world by storm with this climate change rap.
Chucky P.
We can make a difference in our own small way.
It's one small change, we can do that today.
Our mind's getting bigger while the world's getting smaller.
But saving the earth's becoming a tall order.
From the minute you awake from your nightly nap,
you can make little changes like turning off the tap.
While brushing your teeth in the bathroom,
you can cycle or walk your way to the classroom.
Cut down the fuel you used to get to school.
Drastic.
Spread the word, get vocal.
Make it go global.
When buying food, stay local.
Never mind the dishwasher, do it by hand.
But I hate washing up.
Ah, come on, it's grand.
Just one small change in the little things we do.
We'll show you how, and now it's up to you.
It's our future.
It's our earth.
We need to protect it for what it's worth.
It's our future.
So a very busy programme ahead of us today, as always. Sure, it's never not busy. Every Monday evening this programme is busy. Richard, what are you doing? Get away from my cables. Anyway, Richard Collins is here, Aileen Elana is here, and Niall Hatch is here of Birdwatch Ireland. And I'm going to invite our producer into studio now. So Anna Leddy, would you please make your way in? And in the meantime, while she's making her way in and getting herself comfortable at the microphone, she wasn't expecting this, I'm going to let you listen to this unusual sound. Now, ignore the wind. I'm sure that was naturally occurring wind. Anna Naledi is here in studio. Anna, the sound, can you explain, please?
It was late on Friday night in the pitch black in the garden, and my hands were full carrying out some domestic task in the kitchen, so I didn't really get out on time. There was this ferocious screaming going on. What you've heard there is literally just the tail end of it. But as soon as I could, went out and recorded that little bit. But it really did sound like either some poor thing was being strangled to death or the two animals were killing each other. But I couldn't see anything. My husband tells me he saw something silvery slink by. But I doubt somehow if anything was
something
silver.
Something silvery slinking by.
Could possibly.
Good with words.
Could possibly have been something to do with the light shining through the shining out through the windows.
And you want to know what it is?
I want to know what. I'm guessing it's a fox.
Yeah.
How do you know it isn't a person? You cannot ring the guards at once to somebody who has been mugged, raped and robbed in your very back garden. Although this is the time of year for vixens. And that was a female fox, the shameless hussy, looking for a fella. And boy, is she not hiding or pulling her punches. You would not be in any doubt that she was up and looking for the game, would you? Hearing them screeches.
Oh no, I didn't know that's what it was.
Well, what do you think she was doing? Complaining about having the treatment? No, she was looking for it.
There's a bit of mystery about that because sometimes the male give that wonderful screech at this time of year as well. That's one of the peculiar things. The other thing is foxes are very close to each other, the male and the female. For instance, once she gets into estrus, he stays with her all the time. That's to keep other intruders away from stealing his thunder, you see. So why would he bother, or why would they bother screeching at this time of year? If she has a mate and she's in estrus, she wouldn't scream. Now, what she's screaming about, she must be looking for a mate somewhere. But however, what is it? They have a whole load of different calls and shouts and whines and there's a thing called gettering, which is a whole lot of chattering kind of stuff that the babies do a lot of and that the adults do when they fight. Foxes are very mysterious. We don't really know what they're saying to
each other. Well, they certainly are very mysterious for a creature that's so elusive normally. I mean, it stays away from humans. You do see a lot of them around, but they tend to scarper as soon as they see you or if you get close to them. And yet they're so vocal, telling everybody they're there.
But only at that time of year. When
but still.
Well, I mean, on the other hand, all that you could see and your sharp-eyed husband was something silvery slinking by. You didn't actually see the animal at
all. But she certainly got her attention now, I can tell you that. And to answer your...
Have you a big garden?
No, not that big.
No, I know not that big, but I mean, it's obviously...
No, it's a normal, smallish suburban garden. Yeah.
But I mean, Dublin, for instance, you live in Dublin. Dublin has the highest density of foxes, one per square kilometre, and the normal density is one per 20 square kilometres in rural areas, because there's such an amount of food available in Dublin for them. The restricting factor in Dublin actually is spaces for them to actually have a den to get a bit of territory from, because once they mate and they have their babies and they have maybe three or four, they all get booted out at the end of the year towards September, October, and the men have to go and find a new bit of territory for themselves. Sometimes the female cubs, mammy's pets, can stay and help with the next year's lot, but the boys have to get a haircut and a job and get the hell out of there. And quite often they don't actually find territory to establish themselves in. And that's the restricting factor in Dublin, whereas in other parts of the country it isn't so.
Anyway, Anna, thank you very much indeed. Return to your normal position outside in control of the desk. Niall, sit back in there, because here's a man who saw something slinking away one night. It was near your father's house. I always remember this story. And you did contact An Garda Síochána. Remind the listeners what you saw.
At Killiney, yeah.
Killiney.
So my late father used to watch the foxes a lot around the garden, and my mum there still sees them all the time. We've actually had a badger in the last couple of months as well, which is fascinating. But always foxes there. Even during the daytime, you'll see them just curl up sometimes asleep underneath one of the trees. And you see it a lot, and I hear that scream quite often at this time of year. But it was a couple of years ago, I was driving home from the house about midnight, heading home myself, and there was a fox on the wall just leaning down the driveway. And I've seen them there many times before, and usually when the car goes by, they just slink away. When they see a human, they run off. This time it paid no attention to me whatsoever. It was focusing all of its attention down at something that was the end of the driveway on the main road, and it was had its back arched and was hissing and spitting like a cat. The teeth were bared. It was really agitated and looking very aggressive and frightened. And I saw at the end of the road, there was a dog on the road walking along, a big sort of almost Alsatian husky-like dog. And I thought, that's strange, because I've seen foxes and dogs interact before, and what happens is the fox just gets out of there. They go nowhere near the dog, even with small dogs, but this wasn't happening. When I got finally to the end of the driveway and I looked out, I realised, oh, that's not a dog. It was a wolf. It was a wolf, and I've been around animals enough to know what they look like. The way it ran, the way it bounded along the street, the way it held its tail, that look on the face, that muzzle, and the way the eyes are set, a wolf. It sort of lolloped off down the road, and I went to Shankill Garda Station, which is just a couple of kilometres away. This is midnight, remember? And I went in, and I said to them, "Now look, I know you're going to think I'm crazy, but there's a wolf out walking around on the road.
A real four-legged wolf. Yeah. And they said, Right Riding Hood, go home.
No, I was expecting that would be the response, but what the response was, is that thing out again?
Really?
Yeah, it happened before. They knew this animal, and it turned out there were four or five pet wolves within a radius of a couple of kilometres of that station. So people do keep them as pets. You need a licence to keep a dog, but not a wolf.
Really? You don't need a licence? But you have to. You must have an import licence to bring it in.
Well, there's people who breed them here, I believe. And the thing is, they're obviously a very powerful animal. You would really have to know what you're doing if you were keeping one. I mean, the way it is in Ireland, actually, there are very few restrictions on what people keep, so long as it doesn't stray into the areas of animal cruelty. So I remember it was a good few years ago now, I think there was a farmer in Limerick, I believe it was, who was keeping two tigers in his farm, and there was nothing legally stopping him, other than that it turned out the conditions they were being kept in were too cramped, so it breached animal cruelty rules.
The fox obviously recognised that this was a wolf. Yes. Whereas it had been a dog, the fox would have known, but it wasn't going to run away from the wolf. It was staying to face up to it instead of running away, the stupid thing.
It was really interesting.
Why do you think that it was like that?
Somehow
way back in whatever.
Some ancestral genetic memory of what this was, knowing that this was not a dog. And yet
wolves and dogs are the same species, essentially.
Yes, absolutely. But there is obviously some difference, and this fox was able to detect this, because I've never before or since seen a fox act this way in relation to any other animal. It's funny, when sometimes you see cats and foxes interact, and usually what they do is they just completely ignore each other. Just act like, I don't see you, you don't see me, we're just going to go about our business. But when it comes to dogs, they run away. And when it comes to badgers as well, the fox gives way. So you see the badger sometimes coming out, and the fox will slink away and just watch from the shadows.
Well, you learn something new every day on this programme. That's why I love it. Anyway, can I ask you a question about black swans? You, Richard and Aina. I read an article last Friday week, I think it was. It was in the Telegraph, and it said coronavirus is the black swan that might finally sink the markets. And it was all about how China was closing down and production was ceasing, and this could affect the stock markets around the world. But why did they drag the black swan into it? I wanted to know.
It's a reference, I think, to Swan Lake, Tchaikovsky's ballet. The heroine, Odette is her name, I think, she falls in love with the prince, Siegfried. But then the evil demon's daughter, Odile, masquerades as Odette in the second half of the programme. And she corrupts everything and destroys him, and it ends in tragedy. So I would imagine
and that... The first one is the white swan, and the second one is the black swan.
The black swan is Odile.
Yeah.
The prince, of course, thinks she's Odette. It's the same dancer who does both. Apparently it's
but she wears different coloured clothes.
She wears black in the second part of the ballet than she does in the front. It's a very good metaphor, actually, because black swans, of course, are native to Australia. And you get them here at times. They're a bit smaller than our swans. But I must say, having observed them from time to time in flocks, I get the impression that these fellows don't suffer fools gladly. They are tough as nails. And though they're smaller than the other swans, they're well in there and able to hold their own.
But they wouldn't interbreed with our swans, so it's not like
well,
that.
Well, they do sometimes, yeah.
And they have fertile babies.
They do, well, they look very unusual. Really quite an ugly-looking swan. They look kind of off-grey, off-white kind of colour with a very wonky looking beak. That individual up in Donegal was actually reported to us this week by somebody up in Blanket Nook, and it's the surviving member of a pair that was originally there, and they actually even bred once and raised cygnets, pure black swan cygnets in the wild up there in Donegal. I don't know what became of those cygnets. They don't seem to have survived, but one of the adults still does. They must have escaped from a wildfowl collection.
They should do very well because they're black, harder to see, so I'd expect the cygnets to do well. But practically all of the swans tested in places like Slimbridge have interbred. There are seven species of swan. I once looked into this, and some of them, sometimes occasionally, the hybrids of different parents are fertile occasionally. And as you say, the black swan does breed here occasionally in the wild.
Anyway, thank you very much indeed for that, Richard. I kind of knew you guys would know. You can throw anything at these guys. They know everything. Now, it has recently come to light that yet another protected bird of prey has been illegally killed in Ireland. This time the victim was a female hen harrier called Mary, who hatched in the summer of 2019 from a nest on the Isle of Man. She had been fitted with a tracking device which located the bird to a field in County Meath last November. This was part of the EU Hen Harrier Life Project, which involves Manx Bird Life and the RSPB in partnership with our own Birdwatch Ireland. RSPB Investigations and the National Parks and Wildlife Service discovered her body on land managed for pheasant shooting, and their investigation revealed that she had been illegally poisoned. Niall Hatch, who you've already heard there, is Development Officer with Birdwatch Ireland, and we're also joined by Ryan Wilson Parr in our Galway studio, who's a PhD candidate at GMIT with a particular interest in the hen harrier. Hello, Ryan, how are you?
Hi there, how's things? Thanks for having me on.
So tell us a little bit about your studies, first of all.
Okay, well, I guess the study is focused on the largest part of their annual cycle during winter. As you know, Mary came from the Isle of Man over to Ireland, so their movements during the winter are really interesting. And we actually know very little about where they go and why they go certain places. But in Ireland, the hen harrier is protected, and there's an awful lot of effort goes into the breeding season. But we only protect the hen harrier during the breeding season. There's very little being done proactively to protect them the rest of the year.
So are they a native species to Ireland?
Yeah, they're resident breeding species, yeah. So the focus of the research is to find out what they do during the winter, the sites they're using, and this will hopefully inform conservation, planning, land management, all these aspects of their conservation. So it's quite an interesting area of study. And we're using data that's been collected from a voluntary scheme for the last 15 years, the Irish Hen Harrier Winter Survey. So there's an awful lot of data there to use and look into, but we already know quite a lot about their ecological requirements during winter. It's just not really been implemented in a department level, you know. So there's a lot of work to be done. But you've got to commend the efforts for the national parks during the breeding season. We have the designations, we have a farming programme. There's lots to be done, but it's very interesting.
Well, this individual case with this unfortunate female hen harrier Mary has been absolutely disgusting. I think it just goes to show the level of persecution there still against our large birds of prey.
So what's the story of it as we know it?
What happened? Yeah. To give you a recap.
She was tracked, so she had a tracking device, so we can know
right.
the story. Yeah,
absolutely, because you know this is what makes it, I suppose, almost unique. Because how many birds must die without ever being tracked and therefore never known about? So Mary, as we heard, she hatched out last summer on the Isle of Man, where there is a reasonable hen harrier population. And it had been tagged by Manx BirdLife and the Royal Society of Protection of Birds, RSPB. What was interesting, created a big international interest, this bird suddenly flew west and turned up in County Meath. Now, the tracking data after a while showed that unfortunately she was motionless and was lying in the middle of a field, so it was very clear that she must have died. A hen harrier would not do that for hours on end. So an investigation was launched, and Mary's carcass was recovered, and Mary was surrounded by pieces of poisoned meat bait and also a pigeon that had been laced with poison as well.
All on the very spot.
On the very spot, yeah. in this land managed for pheasant shooting. And it was in a place called Drumconrath in County Meath. And so the poison itself was tested, and it turned out to be something called carbifuran, which is one of the most noxious, horrible substances.
And it has been illegal in this country for years and years and
absolutely.
Years.
Absolutely.
So people are obviously stockpiling it.
Indeed.
And you can't buy it anymore.
There is no legitimate reason or legal way to have carbifuran. It's completely outlawed. It's incredibly toxic to humans. I believe even just two drops of it touching the corner of your mouth can kill you. And this unfortunate hen harrier, when she was analysed in the post-mortem, they found that she had poisoned meat in her crop, so she had consumed the poison, and that was what killed her.
But surely when John Gormley was the Minister for the Environment, he changed the bylaws to say that on the land on which this is found, the owners of the land are responsible and therefore can be prosecuted. Is there prosecution charges happening on this?
All I can say is that we know that the National Parks and Wildlife Service investigation is continuing, so we can't say anything that would prejudice that. We certainly hope that the people will be brought to justice for this horrible crime and the people responsible will be
because the way it was before was people who owned land used to say, well, I didn't put it on, somebody put that on my land when I wasn't looking, and escaped all kinds of prosecution. Mm-hmm. And it was John Gormley now, a couple of ministers back, a couple of governments back indeed, a couple of millennia back it would seem at this stage, who changed the law to say that whatever is on your land, the owner is responsible for it.
And what this case has done, because it's involving our colleagues in conservation organisations in the Isle of Man and in the UK, it's attracting international attention. This has made headlines in Britain. This makes Ireland look really bad. And also what's coming to light is that Ireland is now seen as an easy source for these illegal poisons that are then smuggled into the UK. So with the hen harrier particularly, there are big problems on managed grouse moors in parts of Britain where basically zero hen harrier productivity. So in England itself, I believe last year there was just one nesting attempt by a pair of hen harriers. On the Isle of Man itself there were 27. So it just shows you what's happening in England particularly, and also there are issues in Scotland. I'd be interested to know, Ryan, what are your thoughts on that? Have you found that in your research, and how does it differ between maybe Britain and Ireland in that respect?
Well, I guess we know an awful lot about the links between driven grouse shooting and raptor persecution in the UK. It's a shame to think that it goes on in Ireland, but not to that extent. But the fact is, we know very little about the scale of persecution in Ireland. I mean, we have the Raptor Protocol, which is run by the National Parks since 2011, and there's a report every single year. But there's only about 20 to 30 cases recorded each year in Ireland. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. We don't really know, because it's so hard to actually find these incidents and also pursue them to a prosecution.
Ryan,
so the fact is, we need to do a bit more about it.
Ryan, does the fact that this carbifuran, does that tie the death to the location? For instance, if you consume poison, you won't die in the next hour. You'll go on for a while and you digest it and it gets into your gut and you may be miles away before you heal over.
Yeah.
Now, if this bird is found there, does it mean that it was poisoned there?
Absolutely. I mean, carbifuran is a nerve agent.
Very quickly, does it?
Yes, very quick.
It was in the field surrounded by the poison lumps of meat beside it. A pigeon.
This chemical in South Africa became infamous as means for suicide. It became very common there, unfortunately, for suicide. And it was known as two-step because people would take no more than two steps after consuming it. It's almost instant death.
Yeah, that Raptor report is out now. The 2018 one, actually, is just that's just out because it's always the year has to be over before they can make up the results. And in fact, this carbifuran is still appearing again and again and again. The other reason that animals are poisoned is with second generation anticoagulant rodenticides, which are legally allowed to be used as rat poisons. And then animals that are birds that feed on rats may consume this as a secondary source of poisoning. But the Campaign for Responsible Rodenticide Use has been in Ireland now since 2013. And this has brought up a whole way of that the rodenticides must be used in a certain fashion so that it doesn't impinge on non-target wildlife. And these restrictions have been really tightened up this year. And these particular second-generation poisons can only be used by trained odentic users, not even by farmers. Farmers can use a certain amount, but they cannot use them as a permanent baiting. The only people that can countenance permanent baiting are these trained ones. So as a consequence, and it has to be a particular set of circumstances where this is required, so there's been a real cutting back and a real tightening up on the use of these second generation anticoagulants. But we do see some of these, like Prodificom and ones like bromodiolone. These are the ingredients in the rat poisons that are available. Mm. But trying to convince people that permanent baiting is not the way to get rid of your rat populations, because then if you leave it out permanently, not only are the rats eating it, but other non-targets are as well. So this is beginning to work. I mean, you were at this for a long time, 2013, and now suddenly this year it has actually come in. So this is bound to make this raptor report in 2018, it's one of a series, and in fact the numbers are up again. But I mean, whether the numbers are actually up, I mean, you only find a very small proportion of the animals that are actually poisoned, unless, I mean, there was one in Donegal that was poisoned and then put up on a pole for all to see. So, I mean, sometimes these are sort of, as an example for others, appalling cruelty.
Absolutely disgusting. And there needs to be much more done in Ireland about wildlife crime, particularly against birds of prey, but against all sorts of other creatures as well. The law is just often disregarded or flouted, and, the National Parks and Wildlife Service do the best they can, but they're woefully underfunded.
What harm do you think the people who put out this poison think birds of prey are doing? I mean, is it a competition between the birds of prey and the pheasants, birds of prey and the grouse, or what is it? Why are they so agin, these poor birds of prey?
I can't get into their heads to see what's going on there. I mean, certainly there's a lot of misinformation about our birds of prey, that they might be posed to livestock. I think we're getting the word across that they're not. There's no issues there. I think the fact that this was found in an area that it's controlled for use for pheasant shooting may be determinative in this case. I would suspect that in this case that the intended targets were most likely buzzards, which would be quite numerous now in that part of County Meath, and that the hen harrier was just an unfortunate victim.
But why would you want to kill a buzzard even? I mean, what harm was the buzzard seen to be going to be doing? Eating the pheasants?
Again, that's sometimes the allegation made against them. They would take some pheasant chicks. I mean, buzzards, of course, will eat wild birds sometimes. That's what happens. With many of the pheasants, they're reared in captivity and released. They'll be shot. Anyway, that's part and parcel of nature.
So we want to shoot them rather than have them eaten by a bird of prey. We still don't want them to be alive, but we just want to have fun killing them.
And it's, we're really in Birdwatch Ireland, we're desperate to get the message across that these birds of prey that are now slowly but surely returning to the Irish landscape, that they're such a benefit. We're talking there about rodenticides. One of the most powerful natural rodenticides are birds of prey. They eat rats and mice. So when you have birds like buzzards, hen harriers, red kites returning to parts of the countryside, it's an absolutely wonderful thing. They keep these pest populations in check and start to restore the natural balance.
Enlightened farmers know this. And in fact, in some of the farmers that I've heard about are trying to put in areas where barn owls can nest, because since everybody's buildings got all smartened up, there's not so many broken windows and old towers you can nest in, and as a consequence barn owls will need a great big box, and the special barn owl boxes, and you see farmers there putting them up in their land, and sometimes they're inhabited too, which is great.
And Ryan, I know that you've been looking into the nesting sites for hen harriers in Ireland. Can you tell us a bit about that?
The roost sites or nest sites?
The nesting sites for them.
The nest sites, there's a national survey every single 5 years. It's kind of coordinated with the Irish Raptor Study Group, Birdwatch Ireland, and the Golden Eagle Trust and National Park. So we try and get a handle on the national population every single 5 years. And that's part of our kind of reporting to the European Commission. So there hopefully will be a survey this year. And the last survey was in 2015. We know there was about 108 confirmed pairs. And if you add in the kind of territorial birds as well that weren't confirmed nesting, it takes up to maybe 157. Because there has been a consistent decline of hen harrier breeding in Ireland, the first survey properly in 2005 had about 132 to 150 pairs. Okay. And that's gone down every single year. So 2020, we don't really know what the population is going to be. It could be below 100. So there is a real conservation priority here.
And what do you think have been the main limiting factors in terms of their nesting areas? What are the pressures they're coming under?
Yeah, we know an awful lot about their breeding ecology and the threats and pressures. There's been millions of euro invested in looking at the impacts of forestry on hen harrier. So forestry is the main driver of population decline nationally. If you think about how much forestry has taken place in the upland breeding areas for hen harrier, there's about 300,000 hectares of upland peatland that hen harriers would have used has been planted with Sitka spruce, and they can use the early growth stages of forestry, but once that becomes closed canopy, it's unsuitable for foraging and nesting.
That timescale is about 15 years, is it, Brian?
The harvest cycle for forestry, especially Sitka spruce, which is the predominant type of forestry, is about 40 to 50 years. So the first 10 to 12 years, they can use it for nesting and foraging. But the thing about pre-thicket forestry is that there is a higher predator density in second rotation. So in Ireland, there's a legal obligation to replant once it's clear felled. So what we find in the second rotation, when it's growing back after being felled, it has a higher predator density. So any hen harriers that are selecting to nest in that, there's a higher risk that they will be predated with a lower nest survival below a sustainable level. But and that's what's driving this population down.
If you take, we know a lot about the breeding side of
hen harriers, we do, yeah.
But the other 6 months of the year is clouded in mystery, really, isn't it?
We do know an awful lot about their winter ecology. It's just not really been transferred into policy.
How would a harrier behave once the breeding season ends? If you were a harrier, what would you be doing? Roaming the countryside? What would you be looking for? How would you spend your time? Would you meet other harriers, or would you be all on your own? What would be the way of life?
Well, as a young bird, there's a natural tendency to disperse from your natal area. And so you find a lot of these birds will cover large amounts of ground. We know this from satellite tracked birds. Coming from Scotland and Thailand, doing a big tour of the country and then heading back, or coming from Scotland and setting up a core range where they'll spend most of the winter from November through to March. So they are extremely interesting, very mobile, which makes conservation quite challenging. But what we do know is that they are communal, so they do congregate at night in certain places like bogs or fens or marshes. And this could be one bird coming back to the same spot night after night, or it could be up to 10, 15 birds in one location coming in at dusk and then leaving at dawn.
Now this is a pheasant that's targeted. What is the upper limit? I mean, if I'm a harrier, I'm not that big a bird. I'll take a blackbird, I'll take a starling, I'll take something smaller. But a pheasant is a big thing.
Hen harriers aren't known to scavenge. I mean, there has been trials of diversionary feeding in the UK, which has kind of worked, but they wouldn't be known for scavenging. I mean, you'd associate buzzards with more kind of scavenging carrion. Mm-hmm. So it's quite interesting that Mary, this young bird, had obviously seen this kind of food and had a go. So they're quite opportunistic. It's just very sad.
She was collateral damage. I mean, I'm sure she wasn't said.
Would a shooter see this as a rival? I mean, is the harrier going to take the pheasant if I don't shoot it, kind of thing? The pheasant is too big.
Exactly. No, you're quite right. It's far.
Well, Indoraptor account that has come out, the latest one, 2018, the two hen harriers were on the list of the dead, and both of those were actually shot. One beside the other down in County Kerry, actually. So, I mean, somebody went out and shot two hen harriers. I mean,
they're an easy target. They're a slow flying bird generally over the fields, so they're actually unfortunately quite prone to being shot very easily. The same with buzzards too. Buzzards will often soar, so that they make easy targets.
So I mean, the mentality of someone shooting a hen harrier. I mean, you put out the poison for something. they all maintain they put it out for foxes, or crows, which of course is illegal anyway. But they do maintain this, and then these are unfortunate collateral damage. But if you took up your gun to shoot a hen harrier, there's no unfortunate collateral damage there.
There is consequences. I mean, with those two cases, they occurred within special protection areas designated for breeding hen harrier. And those SPAs are now funded by the Hen Harrier Programme, which is a results-based programme, which is totally different from any other agri-environment. It's where farmers are paid for the habitat quality on their farm. And they're also paid bonus payments for having hen harriers on their land. And the way it works is that there's a target for the number of pairs within the SPA each year. And if that target is met, then all the farmers in the programme get a bonus. Now, what's interesting about this case last year was that one of the sites had a target, and it missed that target by one pair. And that was all down to someone going out and shooting these birds. So that hit farmers in the pocket. And it's very, very sad. So we need to try and change that mentality and attach a value.
Is there competition between the idea of forestry and the idea of maintaining land for hen harriers? Or is it the case that Caoilte and the forestry people are not getting away from this great big collection of Sitka spruce trees, all the one species, all the one age, on poor land? I mean, is there any give on that end? I mean, if you're a farmer and you want to plant your land and you can't because it's hen harrier country, are you aggrieved? Have you a case? I mean, is it one against the other, do you think?
So I think it's a bit of both. I think you have to set a context here that when the designation came in, there was an ability to claim drawdown grants and premiums for forestry. And then we realised that forestry was having a very negative impact on the population. So there was a ban, there was a moratorium on forestry in these areas. So what happened at designation was farms were given assurances that they would be given the supports and financial aids for the land being designated and to be managed for hen harrier, but that money didn't materialise.
Well, that's bad.
Farmers were left high and dry. They had no money. So the way they could try and get more money, because a lot of the challenges in these areas is that it's low viability farming. It's very challenging to farm the land because it's marginal and quite rushy. There's a succession crisis where farms aren't being taken over, and there's a lack of kind of income. A lot of the farmers have full-time jobs off the farm. So when they're looking for money, they're looking at, well, this land isn't really making me a lot of money from production, so I need to move it into forestry. But because of the ban, they weren't able to plant it. So the land was essentially devalued, and there was a huge injustice in the designation process because there wasn't ample consultation, there wasn't the financial supports given that they should have been. So they're caught in a very difficult situation where they haven't been given the financial supports, but that's hopefully changing now because the future of the rural development programme is results-based farming and payment for ecosystem services. And I think the experience and reaction from farmers in these areas has been quite positive. So things are changing. And
But if they're only paid when the harriers appear, is that quite fair? I mean, in the sense, you're not planting your trees, you're hoping for the best. Mm-hmm. It takes a while to build up a population of hen harriers. I mean,
There's a big contrast between the farming agri-environment payments and the very high premiums you get from forestry. So those two need to match up.
What's important to bear in mind on that too is that that type of habitat, that sort of upland bog, it's obviously important for hen harriers, but also to a whole suite of other biodiversity, but also especially for things like carbon storage. It's absolutely vital. So in terms of meeting our emissions targets and so forth, this land really needs to be valued. It has to be stopped thinking of it as waste ground. I think it is incredibly valuable for a whole suite of reasons.
Ryan, I want to ask you about the overall picture. What is putting a brake on the hen harrier population? Is it that they're not breeding successfully, not keeping up the number of young to keep the population up? Is it vandalism, poisoning and shooting? Or is it the elephant in the room, the wind turbines, which we're going to flood the country with? Have you any handle on that?
Yeah, we kind of know exactly what the drivers of the population decline are. So you're kind of looking at a number of things. Habitat loss is the key thing. So a lot of that habitat has been lost to forestry now. Habitat fragmentation. So when you think of a provisioning bird selecting an area to nest, it has to forage a lot larger distance to try and get food and come back. So the more fragmented the landscape, that's a pressure. Predation pressure is huge.
From what?
From red foxes predominantly. So during the start of the season, on egg laying, there would be at risk of predation from corvids, egg thieves, and then later on the season it would be more kind of foxes, pine marten, mink. So,
the hen harriers don't have a lot going for them,
and they need a bit of help. So that can be done through kind of land management, and it might not be popular, but some kind of targeted predator control has proved successful. So
we do have a handle on what's driving
the decline. We just need policy implemented.
And what about the wind farms then? You didn't mention those. Are they completely exonerated? Well,
we do know that wind farms do have an impact on the hen harrier population. There's recorded collisions of birds, so there's mortality there. But there's a lot of studies looked into this, both in Scotland and maybe in Ireland, and there is kind of mixed impacts, but there is overall a very negative one. Once a wind farm goes up, you find that birds don't return to breed. There was a paper done quite some time ago that looked at the relationship between turbines and foraging hen harrier, and it kind of showed that within 500 metres of a turbine going up, hen harriers don't come in and forage, because hen harriers use their ears to hunt. They're very good visually, but they use their ears. So once they come into a wind farm, it's almost as if that ability has been distorted with the noise, this turbine-borne noise. So they tend to avoid wind farms for foraging, and definitely for nesting. So,
Ryan, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to speak with us today.
Oh, thanks. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll talk to you again, no doubt, about hen harriers and other things. Niall, a final word on this?
We've been describing just how amazing this bird is and what a boon it is to have it on our countryside and all of the challenges that they face. So the fact that some idiot criminals are killing these things is absolutely appalling. It's making our country look terrible internationally. Now this is making headlines in the UK. The RSPB are on the case. The persecution of these raptors, these birds of prey in Ireland, is really coming to the fore. And again, we wouldn't have known about this case if this bird had not been tracked. That's how her body was able to be found. How many birds of prey out there that aren't being tracked are being poisoned? It must be far, far more than the figures.
And there's no need for it.
No need whatsoever. It's just to reiterate, these birds are nothing but a benefit to our countryside. It's great great to have them here. There is no downside to hen harriers or buzzards. They are magnificent.
Niall, thank you very much indeed for coming in. And I think we need to relax for a few moments. What about a little bit of music from, Swan Lake, perhaps? Now, at this time of year, with the changeable weather we're experiencing, it's more important than ever that we feed our wild birds. A couple of weeks ago, we heard from those delightful fifth-class students in Powerstown Educate Together National School on what they've been doing to help with the wildlife in and around their school in West Dublin. Niamh Nielinchy, from the most picturesque of villages, Julianstown in County Meath, has been on to tell us about how she feeds the birds in her garden. But somewhat unusually, she has feeding stations in both her front and back gardens. And more interestingly, she has different species of birds coming to both stations, yet they're only separated by the width of a house. Curious to find out more, Terry Flanagan went off to the Royal County to meet with Niamh.
Terry, this is one of my feeding stations here.
It's this is the back garden we're looking out at now.
It is indeed, and there's a beautiful holly tree here.
Yes, and in berry too at the moment.
And in berry, yes. I have the birds well trained. They won't eat them till later on. In this part of the garden, right, I have a lovely cage, and then I've several feeders hanging out of it.
And also feeders inside in the cage.
Inside. Now, that's to stop the bigger birds from taking all the food. Right. But the starlings can manage to get into that cage.
Well, I'm looking out there now at the moment and I can see a number of different birds, not just birds, but species. I'm looking, first of all, that little dunnock on the ground there. He doesn't go anywhere near the table, surely.
No, he stays on the ground the whole time. And a very solitary bird.
And the blackbirds I see there feeding off the apples
That's
on the ground.
That's right, yeah.
But mostly what I'm looking at are the tits. There's a lovely little coal tit there. Do you see him just? He's after flying off just this second. And another one's coming down to take his place.
Another one's coming. And look, there's the little robin.
Oh, yeah. Yes, he's on the ground.
Yeah. And then there are an amazing amount of sparrows.
Right.
We have the odd chaffinch coming in, and we have the great tit is there as well. The odd blue tits, not so many blue tits this year.
Right.
And the same normally at this time of the year, you'd have loads of missel thrushes coming in, but haven't seen any so far this year.
So what you're getting really is a great variety of birds. Not only are you getting great numbers, but there's a robin actually at the feeder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't have robins feeding at the feeder in my garden at all. They will only feed on the ground.
Really?
Yeah. They only just take everything that falls. Like, to see that, I'm sorry I didn't get a photo of that, because I seldom see that.
Yeah.
Do they feed off the feeder here a lot?
They feed off the feeder, and they actually go into the cage as well.
Okay.
And you have one on either side of the cage.
And I see here, just coming up beside us, three very, very large birds on the ground. Tell us about these.
Well, Rupert is the rooster, and then we have the Andalusian, which is called Andalusia, and Chickadee. And poor Chickadee has gone into pin feathers. And when a hen is about over a little year old, it loses all its feathers and then it regrows them again. And they're actually thicker when they come back again.
So you also have three hens in the garden.
Yes.
Amazing. Do they feed off the seed?
They do. They get the leftovers.
And tell me this, do you get any sparrowhawks in the garden?
The occasional sparrowhawk comes in.
The only reason
in,
I'm thinking of that is because you have such a wide variety of birds and such great numbers that, and it, there looks like a nice kind of fly through here that he could just
there
come
is,
in.
Yeah, they come down the driveway and turn right past the holly tree, and unfortunately they've been killing a lot of the collared dove.
Yeah, they're a bit slow, really.
Yeah, they're a bit slow. Yeah.
So this is your back garden, feeding lots of different birds, but you also have feeders. In the front garden?
Yes.
Okay,
let's
go and have a little look at that.
Okay.
Because most people would only feed either in one garden, the back garden or the front garden. But you're feeding in both gardens. So we're here now at the front door. We're just looking out. And yes, I can see the feeders and I can see about 15 birds here. And they're all goldfinches.
They're all goldfinches. Yeah, we have started off, there were about six there a few years ago. And it has just steadily built up. I got one feeder and I have three feeders now, and some of them are two-story feeders, and you could get four birds at a time on it.
Right, and I notice it's all Niger seeds you're feeding here.
It's only Niger seeds, yeah, because that's what the goldfinch feed on, and when you have a mixture of birds I find that they start fighting.
Yeah,
and not that the goldfinch can fight.
I'm just looking at them. They're beautiful there. The colours are stunning at this time of the year.
They are, yeah. But one morning I didn't put out the feed for the birds till about 11 o'clock.
Right.
And I thought max that I had about 24 goldfinches coming in. But that morning, right, looking up at the tree, there's a big beech tree.
Yeah, behind me here.
And they all wait up there. Yeah. And there were 50 of them up on the beech tree.
And all of them goldfinches?
All of them goldfinches.
It just goes to show that we really don't have an idea as to their numbers. You'd want to catch each of them and tag each of them individually just to get an idea of the numbers.
Yeah, you really would.
And it just goes to show the importance of feeding. Mm. And once you start feeding in the winter time, that you really need to keep it up.
Yeah. Now, as well as that, we have the odd greenfinch coming in here as well.
I saw one there earlier on. Just one.
Yeah, just one. And last year, we had quite a lot of red pole in, but there hasn't been any this year.
Yeah, I find that in my garden too, that certain years you get certain varieties of birds. If I go back 10 years ago, we would have had 15, 20 blue tits in the garden at a time. Now, this winter, I've only actually seen three since Christmas time.
Yeah.
What we tend to get are quite a lot of house sparrows. Now, I know that's good because their numbers have dropped
their
as well.
Their numbers have dropped.
Do you get
too,
many house sparrows here?
In the back garden.
Yes,
we get a lot of them, yeah.
So here in the front garden, is it all just goldfinches with the odd greenfinch? Is that
it? Yes, that's it, yeah.
That's amazing.
That's it.
And yet there's only, 15 metres between them?
Yeah.
There's no crossover?
There's no crossover at all.
Yeah. And I look, you've quite a lot of trees here in the front garden. And you know what I'm amazed at too? Is the amount of lichens, which tells me that the air is very, very clean here. Yet we're on the main road. We can hear the traffic behind us.
I know. We've 23,000 vehicles passing by the door every day.
23,000 vehicles. Wow, that's a huge number. But it doesn't seem to be affecting the birds in any way.
No, maybe the Leylandis are blocking all the fumes from coming in.
Well, if they are, they're doing a good job.
Not a tree I like.
I see you have a Cotone Aster tree down here as well. Loads of berries on it at the moment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The birds are not taking those, no?
No, they don't seem to like those at all.
Right.
Like, it's like I have two Hypernicum bushes out the back. I think one might be a male and one is a female. The bees will only go for one. So maybe it's something like that with the birds, that it's that particular type of Cotone Aster.
When we were out there in the back garden, there was not only, you'd also a smaller holly tree there that didn't have a single berry on it. So that's obviously a male.
A male, yes.
Because hollies are either male or female.
Yeah.
And you need to have the two trees very close together if you want the lovely berries from
it. That's true, yeah.
So how long have you been feeding the birds here then?
Oh, I'd say since we moved in here in 1986, and I'm feeding them since then.
Yeah. And tell me one or two of the major changes you've seen in that time. So that's about 30-odd years.
In that time, I've seen a dramatic drop in the amount of blackbirds and thrushes. Very, very few thrushes.
Okay. And you're still feeding for them? You're putting out apples and things like that?
I'm putting out apples, for them, yeah.
Have you any ideas to why you think the numbers may have dropped?
I don't know.
Increase in population, or is it?
It's chemicals. Mm. It's way farming is done. But generally speaking, no, nobody has the real answer to it.
What
we know
it's
happening.
What do you think should be done? Have you any ideas to try and stop this loss of biodiversity?
Well, I think that everybody needs to do their little bit, and feed them.
Give us
help
an example.
Them out.
Right, feed them.
Feed them. Yeah.
And help them out. How? How is to help them out?
Help them out. Put up bird boxes.
Yeah.
We have a community garden across the road here, and we've loads of bird boxes as well as that. We've insect boxes. And
You find it works?
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
It does, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, finally, tell me, what's your... Look at that gorgeous goldfinch there. Isn't he beautiful there, just I'm looking at him? And there's three or four more just after arriving as well. And there's a chaffinch there as well. Look, just a male he's just got. Tell me your most favourite bird here in the garden. The one you like to see most every day.
I have to say, I love to see the robin.
Right.
And after that would be the goldfinch.
Well, I can tell you that.
Last year. Oh, yeah, that's one thing I forgot. Last year I had some yellowhammers in the garden.
Really? Yeah, they're a beautiful bird.
And they were just on the ground.
Yeah.
On the tarmac. It was most unusual.
And no, not here anymore?
No, we have a family across the road here, and couple of fields over, we have a pretty large group of yellowhammers.
Yeah. Of course, it's ideal country for it. Now look out there now. The traffic has actually stopped. There's not a single car now. When I came first
and
of all...
no noise.
No noise, yeah.
No noise,
but it doesn't seem to affect the birds.
No, they just come and go.
Yeah. Well, let's just sit back and enjoy these for a little while before I have to go, because it's really, really very soothing here.
Oh, that's lovely to hear.
And all you need to know about how to feed, what to feed and when to feed them can be found on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, sit back and enjoy this special treat. If you haven't already heard these kids, you're going to love them.
Chooky Pee.
We can make a difference in our own small way.
It's one small change, we can do that today.
Our mind's getting bigger while the world's getting smaller.
But saving the earth's becoming a tall order.
From the minute you wake from your nightly nap,
you can make little changes like turning off the tap.
While brushing your teeth in the bathroom.
You can cycle or walk your way to the classroom.
These are the children from Campabwee National School, a tiny two-teacher school in rural County Cork, which has 23 pupils ranging from 5 to 12 years of age. They were so appalled by what they found on the strand while participating in a clean-up of local beaches that they turned the marine waste into an art project and were spurred into writing a song and making a video about it. This they did with the help of a local music producer and a former student doing the filming, all overseen by their teachers. And the rest, as they say, is history. The video clocked up more than 10,000 hits in its first few days online. And at the time of recording this programme, they've had almost 100,000 hits on YouTube alone, with as many as 1.8 million on other platforms. I think it's fair to say that it has gone well and truly viral. Teacher Norma Healy and her talented, environmentally friendly pupils take up the story.
By doing small changes, we can make one big one.
My line is ice caps melting, seas getting high.
Recycle the plastic, bleach is free.
The world is a clock and 12 o'clock is climate change.
The koala bears are dying from the dangerous fires in Australia.
If we don't do something quick, the animals will die.
If they die, they will never come back.
Time is ticking. We better do something before the Earth is destroyed.
What I'm most worried about for the planet is overheating, which will melt the icebergs.
Our emissions are tearing up basically all the stuff that we have to protect us against the bad stuff that's coming into our Earth. We're just ripping up our shield.
If it gets too hot, everything will just start shriveling up and dying.
I'm worried about the polar bears and the ice caps, because if the ice caps keep melting, there'll be a lot of floods and we could all end up underwater.
The thing I'm most worried about is the bees, because they have been around since before or around the time of the dinosaurs, pollinating flowers and plants. So if they go extinct, which is happening because of climate change, the flowers they pollinate will start to die out, and everything that relies on those plants will start to die out, and it's a bit like a domino effect.
I'm worried about nature and everything if climate change goes on, because the heat could kill trees, and trees are what keeps everything alive.
After the beach cleanup, I did some research. I found out that if this continues, by 2050, there'll be more plastic in the sea than fish. We're all very proud of our school. It's really great.
It's not like any other school, really. In a lot of other schools, they will try and come up with excuses to not do these things, but in Campabwee, they just go, eh, what the heck, we'll do it.
It's so small that you can just fit it into one small bus.
We can actually fit in the back of a Jeep, all of us together. I've been to 4 schools, and this is the best one.
I'm really, really proud of the kids here in Campabwee School. I suppose being in a small two-teacher school is a really unique experience, and we listen to every voice from the youngest to the oldest, and it really, it's like being in one big happy family, to be honest.
If we have 66,000 people watching our video, we hope that that makes 66,000 small changes, and that kind of has a knock-on effect. It was kind of a shock to see how many people had heard of it and had watched it.
You never expect this kind of stuff to happen. I mean, sometimes it does and you get 15 minutes of fame, but we've had more than 15 minutes.
I don't exactly feel famous yet, but by the time our video gets over 1 million views, then going to town's going to be a nightmare.
Put down the fuel you used to get to school.
Too drastic.
Spread the word, get vocal.
Make it go global.
When buying food, stay local.
we found out the Earth was sick. We knew we had to do something quick. The Earth is our family and our friend.
We need to mend it before it ends.
This is our home, so don't destroy it. Everyone should do their bit. Ice caps melting, seas getting high. Homes will be flooded, polar bears will die.
In the sea.
It's like people use this planet as a bin. Pick up your trash, that's where you begin.
Temperature is rising, we are realizing.
We must act now, there's no compromising.
Just one small change in the little things we do.
We'll show you how, and now it's up to you. It's
up to you. And that's pretty much all we have time for today. Just before we go, Aina, you want to mention something for our listeners to take part in?
You've been a great devotee of Eurovision.
Yes, I am.
Well, this is the Eurovision, not of people singing songs, but of trees, Derek, of trees. So the Irish entry this year to the European competition of Tree of the Year is the Witch's Yew in Blarney, down in County Cork. Now, we did have an All-Ireland competition and the Witch's Yew was selected as the Irish runner for this. And this is a yew tree that's been, we reckon, up to 1,000 years old. Great big roots growing on the top of a big crag, and the roots are so big and round. That was actually a witch's cave underneath. And the witch comes occasionally, and we see the remains of her fire in the chimney from time to time. And if you walk down the steps backwards without killing yourself stone dead, you could actually have a wish. But however, this is our witch's yew at any rate, and this is going forward to compete for the best tree, the tree of the year in Europe. Now, there's about 12 or 16 other, I think there's 16 trees in the competition altogether from all the different European countries. But the way it's going to win, like Eurovision in general, is by voting. So I exhort everybody to go onto the website and click for the Witch's Yew and vote for our tree. You can see the actual, you can only vote once, as I discovered. You can't do it several times because they know your computer. But you know, you can vote from different devices, whatever else. We need our Witch's Yew to win, and we need the people of Ireland to vote for it. And the voting is only for the month of February. So if you haven't done it by now, straight away, stop even listening to the end of this programme. Go and do it now. Vote for the Witch's Yew, because we want to have the best
for the European Tree of the Year. That's rte.ie/Mooney for all details. My thanks to Aina Nealon.
And it's the Tree Council website.
Tree Council of Ireland, yeah. My thanks to Aina Nealon, to Richard Collins and Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland, our researcher is John Riley, and the series producer was Anna Leddy. Don't forget, vote for the European Tree of the Year, the Witch's Yew, from
Blarney in County Cork.
Blarney in County Cork. rte.ie/Mooney. Till next week, bye!
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.